This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark. I'm back with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And this week, I find myself in beautiful Manhattan Beach, California, and I'm with a legendary trainer for the Los Angeles Lakers, recently retired, Gary Vitti. So, Gary, first of all, how are you doing?
I've never been better in my life, and thanks for having me, and thanks for asking.
Oh, man, it's crazy because as we were talking about just shortly before we went live here, rarely does it rain in Southern California, yet I have a 206 number. I'm originally from Seattle. It looks like I actually brought the rain down here.
Yeah, you sure did, but it's okay because we need it.
Well, you probably remember back in the day, I'm just kind of riffing here, but the Rain Man, I saw him actually with a picture with Detlef Schrempf, who's a friend of mine, last night. The old classic Seattle Sonics playing against your Lakers. Mm-hmm. There's some amazing battles back in the day.
Yeah, if it wasn't for us, they might have had a shot at it.
Yeah. Right?
But, you know, all roads had to go through the Lakers to get to the championship. During the decade of the 80s, you know, we were pretty much going to be there. You had to go through us to try to get there.
Yeah, there's no question about that. Yeah. So let's start off, because you've had this amazing career, 13 different coaches you played through. You're able to sustain that, 8 championships. The most amazing players, we'll get into it, Magic, Kobe, Kareem, Worthy, Byron Scott. The list goes on and on and on and on and on. And we'll get to that in a minute, but the first thing is I was kicking back, and my career has always been on the football side of things, and we were just talking about George Anderson and now Rod Martin for the Raiders, and I guess, like, those guys are staples. They've been there forever. In your case, 32 years. How does somebody even become the trainer for the L.A. Lakers, one of the most iconic franchises in all of sport?
Yeah, I get that question a lot, Mark. And my path to the NBA was a bit circuitous. You know, most athletic trainers today go to school right off the bat as a freshman in college, knowing that they want to be an athletic trainer. That wasn't me. As a matter of fact, I graduated from college in 76, which means I went in 72. And although there's been athletic trainers around since the Gladiators, a real major in athletic training at the college level, evidence-based practices of sports medicine, really didn't exist. There weren't that many athletic training programs in the 70s. So, you know, in terms of myself at that age, at 18 years old, I didn't even know what an athletic trainer was or where would you go to become one. That information didn't exist. There was no information highway, you know, internet stuff in those days. Yeah. I was just oblivious to you know, being an athletic trainer. So, you know, you finish high school, you go to college. I didn't know what I wanted to do when I grew up, and I knew I had to graduate from college. And I went into the corporate world. Other than making money, that sort of left me empty. And so I tried to figure out something else to do, and I was always pretty good in sciences, and I ended up directing my efforts to go into meteorology. So I had never been out west. I decided to go to the University of Utah and major in meteorology. I was accepted into the program there. And it didn't take me long to figure out that the people that go into meteorology are mathematicians and physics type people. And, yeah. and I could do that kind of stuff, but they were real brainiacs. I mean, I really had to work at it. It was drudgery for me, where those types of things became very natural to the other people in the program. I literally only remember, you know, the sine, the cosine, and the vectors and that kind of stuff. So one semester in, I realized I'm probably in the wrong place. I take a drive out to L.A. over Christmas vacation, and two of my friends from undergrad were swim coaches at UCLA. And I was kind of whining to them about, you know, I'm in this program, but I'm in the wrong place. I know I am, but I can't get out because that's where I'm at. You know, I got to finish what I started.
Yep.
And one of them gave me a book. The book was called The Sports Medicine Book, and it was written by Gabe Merkin. And it was probably the first over-the-counter sports medicine book that wasn't a textbook-type book. And I read it on the plane. We all flew back to JFK because we're all from the East Coast to visit our families. I read the book on the plane. I said, you know what? This is, I think, what I want to do. I returned back to the University of Utah. I went to visit the head athletic trainer there, Bill Bean, who was unbelievably gracious with his time. And he told me, you know, this is a great profession, but you can't get into our, they have one of the best programs in the country, because you can't get into this program. It's full. We have a waiting list. And I said, okay, would you mind if I, in my free time, just showed up in the training room, I'll stand in the corner, I won't touch anything, I won't talk to anybody. I just want to be a fly on the wall and see what happens in a collegiate athletic training room and figure out if this is really what I want to do. And he said, sure. And that's what I did. Every waking moment, I would go in the training room and stand in the corner. And you know about this, but anyone that's been in Division I college football training room before practice, it's pretty wild in there.
It's chaos.
I mean, yeah, it's chaos. These guys are big, they're strong, they're crazy. There's a lot of testosterone flying around. Everybody's trying to get on the practice field at the right time.
Everybody's trying to get taped up on their ankles.
That's it, yeah. Yep. There's, you know, all sorts of things going on. And I say in the book that it's an interesting phenomenon that I learned. If you hang around a place long enough, you become part of the fabric of the place. You become recognized. And that's what happened with me. And one of the players then asked me for something one day. But I didn't want to do it because I didn't belong there, okay, other than for observation. So I ran over to Bill Bean, the head trainer. I said, big guy over there asked me to get him something. I don't even remember what it was. It was something benign, like a Band-Aid or something.
Yeah.
And he said, just do it for me, because he was, you know, really busy. All the other athletic trainers were busy. And I did it. And sort of with that single opportunity, I crossed over from observation to actually doing something in the training room. Soon after that, we had a very big snowfall, and a couple of the student trainers called in sick. They weren't sick. They went skiing.
Yeah.
And Bill Bean wasn't dumb. He figured that out, and he was very upset, and he kicked them out of the program, which made room for me. So I matriculated out of the meteorology program into the sports medicine program, got a second bachelor's degree and a master's degree inside of 2 years. Started my PhD, and the other interesting thing where the stars lined up for me was in 1979 when I arrived at the University of Utah. That's the same year that the New Orleans Jazz moved from New Orleans to Utah.
Yeah.
And so now there's an NBA team in town. And so I'm in the graduate program, and they call the university athletic department, and they say, we'd like to have a part-time assistant athletic trainer. And I was a football trainer. I didn't work basketball at the U. And so I had some extra time, and they sent me down there. And I started helping out with the Jazz. And now my name started running through the NBA. We had an assistant coach there, Bill Burka. Bill is now 93 years old, and he still works for the Lakers.
Mm.
And when they fired Paul Westhead and they hired Pat Riley as the head coach, his first call was to Bill Burka, and he came to the Lakers.
Hmm.
I had since left the University of Utah, took the head job at the University of Portland. I was there for 2 years. the Lakers job opened up, and Burka told Riley the guy you should talk to was me.
This is now roughly 1981.
This is now 1984.
1984, okay.
1984. And so I get a call from Jerry West's office. We would like to speak to you about the head athletic trainer's position. I really wasn't that interested. I had worked a couple of years with the Jazz as an assistant. You know, my goal was to finish my PhD and be in academia the rest of my life and working at a Division I, you know, university, big-time athletic program and teaching, you know, student trainers. But, you know, it's the Lakers. So they sent me a first-class ticket. I had never flown first class before, mm-hmm. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, Jerry West picked me up at the airport in a navy blue Mercedes with tan interior. I had never been in a Mercedes before, and Jerry West is driving it.
You're talking about the logo.
Yes.
You're talking about the logo, Jerry yes. West. All right.
Jerry West, my childhood idol, picks me up at the airport at LAX, drives me to the Fabulous Forum,
yeah.
And it just happens to be that that day is the day that USA basketball was playing Spain for the gold medal in the 1984 Olympics. So I'm flying around first class. I'm getting picked up in a Mercedes by Jerry West. I'm going to the Forum. It's an electric building during the Olympics. And I'm on like this magic carpet ride. And I go from saying, you know, I'm not that interested in working in the NBA to, boy, they really do things the right way down here. I want this yeah. job. And I interviewed with Pat Riley and Jerry West for about 6 hours. And then instead of Jerry driving me back to the airport, they told me to walk across the street. There was an old seedy hotel there called the Airport Park Hotel, and that I could grab the shuttle to take me back to LAX, which was a little bit depressing. Yeah. Maybe they didn't, you know, want me, is what I was thinking. But I flew back to Portland, where I was living at the time, and a couple of days later, they called me and offered me the job, and the rest is history.
Wow. Well, yeah. Look, there's a lot to unpack here, so let me go back one by one.
Okay.
All right, so before we get into the whole Laker gig, I want to ask you about the evolution of the athletic trainer, okay? So, and I want to start first with my own experience. And outside of taping, and I don't want to take anything away back in that day, because when I got to the University of Washington, we're kind of in that same period as a player. It's 1980 to 1985 and then on to the NFL. And things are way more sophisticated today, just like this new blog you have going called The Vitti Report, which you're really getting into the diagnosis and what's going on when you say a hamstring injury or something like that. The joke for us as players used to be, that no matter what would happen, you sprained ankle, you blew out your knee, you had something wrong with your shoulder, ice it, mm-hmm. ice it, ice it. And there's no question that you know, icing it, you know, is a remedy out of the gate. But it's like, I could have been a trainer, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to minimize any of the,
no, I get
it. The guys back in the day, but there's been this huge shift, right, from what you described early on and what I experienced as a player, from the kind of care and the diagnosis and the treatment that you're getting now versus, I think, you know, the way it was certainly years behind, mm-hmm. years before.
Yeah, so let me say it again. There's been athletic trainers around since the gladiators, but the actual discipline of sports medicine is relatively young. It's probably only about 40 or 50 years old, and it's taken a giant leap in the last 10 or 15 years. But let's go back about 40 years, you know, for me. That's basically why the Lakers offered me the job. Because prior to that, there was sports and there was medicine, but there wasn't sports medicine.
Yeah.
So that transition came around the late 70s, early 80s, where you had athletic trainers that actually graduated from an athletic training or sports medicine program. I would have been one of the first PhDs. Okay? Now, almost everybody at the college level has a PhD or an EdD in athletic training, but none of them existed. I think I can think of one guy, Ken Knight, you know, was at Indiana. The only programs were like Indiana, Arizona, Utah. You know, there were just a few programs in the country. And so, you know, sports medicine as a discipline is very young. And as a result, I was at that right at the right time in the right place, at the cutting edge of the evolution of sports science. Now we fast forward 40 years. It's become exponential in terms of its development.
Yep.
You know, even when I broke in, if a guy had a medial collateral ligament tear, he had an arthrotomy, meaning they cut you open, all right, and try to fix the ligament. Now, for the most part, medial collateral tears are just immobilized for a period of time. There isn't a surgery. Same thing with AC separations of the shoulder. They used to screw them down in those days. Now they just leave them be. Okay? But if you do need surgery today, where when you played, they would probably have to do an arthrotomy, meaning, once again, you have to cut open all the way to the joint. Now they put a few puncture holes, portals in there.
Totally,
and they
different
do
deal.
It where, so the arthroscopy... Yeah. Arthroscopy changed everything, and that happened right around the time that I was coming out of graduate school. Then you add MRI and diagnostic ultrasound to it. So how would you evaluate a soft tissue injury? Well, you know, strength, pain, range of motion, you do a physical exam. Now we have objective instrumentation. We can do a scan. We could do it with an MRI. We can do it with an ultrasound wave. And we can actually see the tissue, how much damage there is, and figure things out a little bit better. And then what do you do about those injuries? You know, we have high-speed cameras now. Every arena has 6 cameras in the sky. And they shoot 25 frames a second. And recognize all 13 people on the court, 5 players on each team, and the 3 officials. And those cameras are put there for basketball analytics. But there's a lot of information from a sports medicine standpoint that we can extrapolate. For instance, we can tell the number of accelerations and decelerations of every player on the floor. From that, we can come up with a number which is the average speed that player ran for that game. Hmm. We can also tell the exact distance that they ran. So suppose we came up with an equation for load that was average speed times distance times the player's body weight. That was the load on that individual for that particular contest. Now, another objective measurement is the minutes that they played. So we divide that load by the minute, so we have a second number we call intensity. And as athletic trainers, what we're looking at is we want to see a direct linear relationship between load and intensity. As load's going up, we want to see intensity go up with it. If it's not, then we start asking questions why. And if you're in what I call the green zone, so a stoplight, red, yellow, and green. If you're in a green zone, we're pushing you on load, pushing you in games, pushing you in training room. Everything looks good. You're not falling into any postural distortion patterns. Your movement efficiency is good. But if you start dropping into a yellow zone, now we question why. Maybe it's because you're guarding Stephon Curry. Or maybe it's because you got in a fight with your girlfriend, or you didn't sleep well, or you're sick, or you're injured. But we start asking those questions, and we come up with scales that we call RPE scales, rated perception of exertion. And we add that into the equation. If you're in the red zone, then you're going to get hurt. And so we've probably shut you down, or trying to do a correction on you. Coach has probably pulled you out of competition anyway, because you're in the red zone, your performance probably isn't good because you're not moving well. These things didn't exist back in the day. You had eyeballs, so you could look at your athlete and think you know what you're seeing. But now we can do all this objectively. There's no subjectiveness in it. You can't lie to the camera. And then you add wireless sensor technology on top of it, where I just mentioned something about postural distortion patterns. We can put wireless sensors on you, and we only need two. It's not like we have to put them all over your body, and they're the size of a quarter. We put two on you. We can tell you how long your left foot's on the ground compared to your right in milliseconds. We can measure ground reaction force, how much force are you generating right versus left. We measure that in newtons. We can tell if your knee is going into valgus, means turning in, which is where you become most susceptible. Also with the sensors, we can measure the exact distance, speed, all these things. None of that existed. You've almost taken all of the guesswork out of it now with objective technology, and it's not very expensive. So compared to the time when you played and the time when I came in, it's a different world.
Yeah.
And in the book I write, the last chapter is the evolution of sports science.
Well, what it must be so fascinating for you too, right? So rather than just show up every day and do the same thing with the same players and it's the eyeball test and you're more reactive, you're in this proactive relationship with really being able to tackle technology and apply it to all these different players to really maximize what they are. And as you're going through all this, the one guy of all these amazing players that you've been around and you've treated and you've worked with, I just can't imagine that Kobe Bryant wouldn't be in green zone at all times, man, right?
Yeah.
The guy is just a machine. He operated at a high speed, a high level, and it seemed like he was always pushing himself. And so that must have been fascinating to work with a guy like that. I'm sure there's others, but to me, when you were saying that, he just seems like the example of a guy that really take care of his body and really understand how to operate it.
Yeah, I think I'm going to probably surprise you with what I'm going to say next. The chapter that's most about Kobe's peppered through the book quite a bit, but the book is a series of chapters that are lessons that I learned about happiness, greatness, and leadership. What Kobe taught me was that you can never have enough talent, but talent is the most overrated thing in life.
Yeah.
So what if I told you, you ready for this?
Yeah.
Kobe wasn't that talented. Would that surprise you? Because it surprises most people when I say that.
Well, I would go to say the first thing I would agree with what you just said, which is about the best isn't necessarily the most talented. And I experienced that firsthand because I was not the best and I was not the most talented. But there were other things that I did that made me put me, you know, above or in front of those others that should have been playing or were cut because they weren't paying attention to detail and all the other things that they should have been doing.
Yeah, you found a way.
I found a way,
and,
right.
And that's what Kobe did. So when you look at Kobe Bryant, I mean, he's a large human being in terms of normal people, okay? Yeah. But in terms of the NBA, he's not that big.
Yeah.
Okay? Kobe was fast, but he's not that fast compared to other players in the NBA. He was quick. He's not that quick. Okay? He could jump, but he couldn't jump that high. So what was there about Kobe Bryant that he ends up with five rings, and there's all these other players that were so much more gifted end up with no rings? And here's the answer to that. Let's give him the fact that he was talented. He just wasn't the most talented. So the second thing is hard work. Nobody worked harder than Kobe, but a lot of players work hard. In addition to working hard, Kobe worked intelligently. He was really smart about how he expended his energy, committed himself to the game. The third thing was, if we say that talent was one, hard work, intelligent hard work is two. Third thing was competitiveness. He was more competitive than anyone I've ever been around, and I've been around some great champions. And I'll tell you this, he would cheat your two-year-old in a game of tiddlywinks to win because he needed to win. He had to win. That it meant everything to him. It meant so much to him that if he didn't win, if he lost, he used the loss to come back better and stronger the next time so that he wouldn't lose again. And then the last thing was he was tougher. He was just physically and mentally tougher than anyone I had ever been around. by taking the words can't and won't out of his lexicon and replacing them with can and will. Mm-hmm. He willed himself to do things. And I'll add one more thing. He was intellectually brilliant at many things, but whatever he decided to do, he became intellectually brilliant at it. He studied it. He just didn't try to go out and do his best. He worked at it. He studied it, and he studied it until he became the best at whatever he tried to do. Not just basketball, but anything.
I love that. So I want to refer to the book really quickly, just so we don't get loose out of that. The book that you recently completed, 32 Years of Titles and Tears from the Best Seat in the House. And again, just reiterating what you just said, what I learned about greatness, leadership, and the evolution of sports science. So, you know.
And happiness.
And happiness. Well, I'll say one thing. When you win, you're happy. You know, losing sucks, right? We all know that. Yeah. I think there's another element in there, too, and that is organization, right? So you're talking about one individual player, and I know you probably agree with this, but when you're talking about those names, which you did about Jerry West, and then you dropped in Pat Riley, your head coach, for, you know, a decade. But the leadership really starting with Dr. Jerry Buss.
That's correct.
Right?
Yes.
And then that goes to you as well. So it's just everybody has a piece in that puzzle, and then bringing in other players to surround. The kind of the first run was with Magic, James Worthy, Byron Scott, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and then you went into the second phase of championships, and then that's where Kobe and the other guys, Shaq, mm-hmm. came in. And they had that really amazing dynamic, but all those same pieces, there was a different coach between Pat Riley and your other coach, Phil Jackson. But at the end of the day, a lot of the pieces were still the same, different players, but yet the management, the leadership, the ownership group was all intact, really putting in those different players in the position to succeed.
Yeah, it always starts from the top. And Dr. Buss was a great owner. And he hired great people. I was always surrounded with greatness from the top on down. You know, speaking of Dr. Buss in particular, in the way I've described him was that he hit the trifecta of human values for me, which was honesty, kindness, and loyalty. And he hired the right people, and then he left them alone. He let them do their jobs, and they did those jobs and did them well. The other guy in there besides Jerry West and Pat Riley when I first came in was Bill Sharman.
Yeah.
So Bill Sharman, the Lakers played the Celtics and the Knicks, I think 7 times, and could not win a championship until Bill Sharman showed up. So people that don't know Bill Sharman is one of 3 people in the Hall of Fame, the Nesmith Basketball Hall of Fame, that are in there both as a player and a coach. It's only 3 people that are in that way. And he also is one of the only people that ever played professional baseball at the major league level and professional basketball. He played for the Brooklyn Dodgers and he played for the Boston Celtics. Yeah. So he was a great athlete, and he was on the Celtics, which has always been the Lakers' nemesis. And I think he won 6 championships predominantly against the Lakers. When the Lakers needed a coach in 1972, Jack Kent Cook hired Bill Sharman. And it was Bill Sharman, an ex-Celtic, that taught the Lakers how to actually win.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, again, it takes a full team of people to really, you know, mature and come together to win those types of championships. And sometimes it's just funky dynamics, taking players from different parts of the country. So when we get into Pat Riley, and now here comes along Magic Johnson, right? You bring him in from Michigan State. Was it Pat's intensity, or was it Magic's intensity that created that dynamic that they had with the right players, but having the right coach and the right point guard and the right personalities to really make that thing go?
Okay, so So you got to go back a little bit because Magic was drafted in 1979.
That's right, with Larry Bird, yeah.
Yeah, and so Pat was not the coach then. Pat was actually in the broadcast booth.
It was Paul Westhead, right?
Well, actually, before that, it was Billy McKinney.
Okay.
And then McKinney got into a bicycle accident and couldn't coach anymore, so then Westhead took over. And then Westhead took Riley out of the broadcast booth and made him an assistant coach. And then after Westhead actually won the championship in 80, so they drafted Magic in 79, won the championship that same year, 79-80, because, you know, crosses the new year. And then going into the next year, they fire Westhead, and then they make Pat Riley the head coach.
Right.
And then he brings in Bill Burka.
Yep.
And then they go on to have basically the rest of the decade of, for the most part, being on top, winning five championships from 79 to 89.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned Riley and you mentioned Magic, and absolutely those were two of the main cogs in the wheel. But the other guy that you have to mention is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Absolutely.
And I make a very strong argument in the book that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar may not only be the greatest basketball player that's ever played the game, but he may be the most successful athlete to ever walk the planet.
What do you mean by that?
If you look at what he's accomplished in sports from the time that he was a child, he's won everything.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you could possibly win, and he's done it multiple times. He was in the playoffs 18 times out of 20 years. You know, he's got six championships with two teams. When he retired, we never won again until the Kobe Shaq era. So even though Magic was still playing, you know, he didn't win without Kareem. Kareem was great. But it wasn't just that. I mean, it was the whole team was put together by Jerry West. And you use the term puzzle, and I use that in the book as well. And what I say is being on a team is being part of a puzzle. There are no extra pieces. If you are short a piece, then the puzzle's not complete. And you know there are no extra pieces. So you have to find your place in the puzzle and fit into that place, which many times means that you have to sacrifice a piece of yourself to fit into the puzzle. And that's what Pat Riley and Phil Jackson, because of the 13 coaches, went to the finals 12 times. I have 8 rings. Of the 13 coaches, all 8 rings are just with two.
Yeah.
Riley and Phil.
Okay. Yeah.
That's what they were good at. Getting players that had their own egos and their own agendas and getting them to sacrifice a piece of themselves for the good of the whole to win.
Why did Magic Johnson and Kareem, why did that relationship work? Because you have this young, brash kid, you know, coming in from Michigan State, who is just electric, smile, phenomenal player. And then you had Kareem, who'd been there for years, you know, the skyhook, much more quiet, mannered, very bright, very smart. And it just seemed like whatever that was, I don't know if it was Magic had to put his ego at the door, but it seemed like that dynamic worked.
It did. And for a couple reasons, even though people kept saying that it was Magic's team because he had the ball in his hands most of the time, especially after they traded. That's why they traded Norm Nixon, to get the ball in Magic's hands, because he was best when he had the ball in his hands and then he could give it to other people. So Magic had the ability to take what other people were saying, you know, which is, this is your team, and saying, it's not my team, it's Kareem's team. And so I know that Kareem really appreciated that and didn't have to fight for the attention and the leadership, because he wasn't the kind of guy that would do that. He would just kind of go into his shell. So they complemented each other in that way. And then the other thing was is that their basketball IQ was so high that they knew how to get the what was best out of each other and then hide the warts. Because Magic is now a 6'9 point guard.
Yeah.
He can't guard guard Isaiah Thomas. So we had to adjust things. You had to put Byron Scott, the two guard, which is unfair to Byron, okay, because he would normally be guarding two guards. Now he's guarding point guards. He never got any credit for that. So the entire team, and especially Magic and Kareem's warts at that time was he was aging. He was slowing down, couldn't jump anymore, but he could still play. You know, so they had to sort of work on what complemented each other and then hide what didn't. And their basketball IQs, not just them, but the entire team and the coaches were so good that it just worked. It worked. The chemistry was good.
What was that like for you when Magic came out and announced that he had the HIV virus?
Yeah.
So, and how did you do? I mean, outside of just your reaction, like obviously you must have been in the room. I mean, I can't imagine being in your position, what that was like to try to manage that. And at the same time, we really didn't know what that meant.
Yeah, this is a whole chapter in the book, and and I'm going to try to do this without getting emotional because it takes me back to a very dark place. The way this whole thing went down was we played the Chicago Bulls in the finals in 1991, and we lost. And at that time, I really had bought into the American sports creed that there's winning and there's misery, and there's nothing else in between. And so we were all quite miserable that whole off season, and now we're going into training camp. And the only way you can get out of the misery of losing is to avenge the loss. You have to go back out and win. That's what keeps you right. in the game, is winning. And so all our sights were all on, okay, let's get back to the finals. Let's meet Michael Jordan again. Let's, you know, avenge the loss. But we start that season by going to Paris and playing in the McDonald Cup. We come back, and in the NBA, there was eight preseason games. And we had played six, two of them in Europe. And so we have two more to play, one in Salt Lake City and one in Vancouver, British Columbia. And so Magic calls me up. We had just gotten back from Paris, and he says, hey, listen, I'm worn out from the travel. I don't want to play in these last two games. You know, opening night is in a few days, so I could really use the rest. I said, okay, let me see what I can do. I called Jerry West, and I said, Jerry, Mag is kind of worn out. You know, we're going to open up next week, and maybe it's best to rest him. He said, well, he can take off the Utah game, but he's got to play in Vancouver. And this is before they had a team. Now they're in Memphis, but yeah. At one point Vancouver had the Grizzlies. He says, he's got to play up there. The game's not sold out. If they find out he's not coming, then they're not going to sell the tickets. So I relay that to Magic, and he says, well, if I have to play in one, I might as well play in both. I said, well, that's you. It's up to you. Okay. So we fly to Salt Lake City. It's before cell phones, get to the hotel, and I have all these messages to call the office, which I do. And Jerry West, I had this really cryptic conversation with him, and says, I need you to send Magic home. Is why he won't tell me, and that's odd because Jerry and I had this great working relationship. And so I call Magic. I said, "What's going on, man? I'm supposed to send you home." He goes, "I don't know. I got the same phone call. I thought you could tell me." And I said, "I have no idea." You know. So I sent him home, and now I mean, you can imagine the position I'm in. Oh, what's going on? You know, the guy didn't want to go. They said he had to go. Now they're telling me to send him back.
And it's also unusual for the trainer, who is always cozy with all the medical people.
Yeah, so, I mean, something's up.
Yeah.
You know, we're already significant, almost done with training camp. All his physical exam info is back, his cardiology, all his blood panels. Anything that would have been something would have shown up. I would have found out about it. And so I really couldn't put my finger on it. So we play the game against the Jazz, and I'm there. I'm in the game, but I'm mentally really not in it because I'm racking my brain and what could be wrong with our superstar. And then it hits me that besides our physical exam, we had done a life insurance physical exam for a life insurance policy. And that exam required an HIV screening. Hmm. The NBA physical exam does not. As a matter of fact, we wouldn't be able to screen a player unless he asked for it, because it would be a violation of their civil liberties. So it's not something that would have shown up on our blood panel. And that's when it hit me. The one thing that was different was this second physical exam that we had just done.
So you didn't know the fact. You were just putting the pieces together. And what was the gap?
I'm guessing. Okay,
right.
I'm guessing.
Yep.
You know, the lifestyle that he was leading and so on and so forth, and the tests. And so we play the game, and we go to Vancouver, British Columbia, to play the next night. And I get a call the next morning from Dr. Mickey Melman, our team physician at the time. Before he could say anything, I said to him, he's HIV positive. And, excuse me. He said, yeah, I figured you'd figure it out. And I said, well, what's the plan? And he said, well, first thing we're going to do is we got to retest them to make sure it's not a false positive. Second thing is you need to come in and get screened. And the third thing is you don't tell anybody. Mm-hmm. We figure out what we're going to do. I said, okay. So we go back to LA.
Wait. You, meaning yourself, needs to come in, because at the time, is it because we thought that just by touching people, was that
something
the idea?
Like that. We had no idea how long he had been HIV.
Yeah. And so
positive.
There's just all this ignorance that we didn't know.
In those days, you could, same thing in the NFL, you could bleed all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody stopped the game, you know, for a bloodborne pathogen.
No, they just keep going.
You know, so who knows, you know, what you were in contact with.
Yeah.
So I wasn't worried about it, but the test came back negative, so it's always good to know.
Yeah.
And then the last thing he told me, and he wants to meet you, you know, tomorrow morning when you get back and before anybody else comes in. So we met at like the crack of dawn at Loyola Marymount, which was where we were practicing that day, and just the two of us in the locker room.
And this is you and Magic.
Magic and I, yeah. And I'm a wreck.
Yeah. Okay?
And, you know, can't sleep, can't eat, can't think about anything else, you know, because at the time, like you see, I don't understand why I'm still emotional about it to this day, because he looks great. He's going to outlive us all, but it takes me back to such a dark place. And so I said to him, I go, you know, how you doing? I said, because I'm not doing well at all with this. And you know, because I thought he was going to die, right?
Yeah.
And he kind of squatted down to get to eye level with me, and he grabbed me by the shoulders, and he looked me straight in the eye without a hint of self-pity. He said, When God gave me this disease, he gave it to the right person. I'm going to do something really good with this.
Yeah.
And, you know, it really, the courage that he showed at the time was, you know, it was really something for me. But at the same time, I'm saying to myself, is he in denial? I mean, doesn't he really understand what's going on here? But now we look back on it, he did exactly what he said he was going to do. And for the courage that he showed during that time, you know, I learned several things, that the true test of one's character is when things are going badly, not when everything's going your way. And the second thing was, as I said before, that I bought into the American sports creed of there's winning and there's misery. And I never considered that happiness really relies on not achieving what you're chasing, but being grateful for what you already have. And that begins with your health and that of your loved ones. I think it's good to chase things. I think it's good to want more. But I don't think your happiness should rely on it. If it does, then you'll have lots of short bouts of happiness through your life that'll be separated by misery, you know, when you don't acquire what it is that you're chasing.
Yeah, really well said. You know, as you're telling the story, And again, it's a different day today than it was at that point in time when there was all this uncertainty. And I've always thought that he is, if not the, one of the top two or three best point guards. And point guard is not just about distributing the ball. It's just not about shooting the ball and hoisting it up. But it's also about leadership. And there's nobody that was more electric that can bring more people around himself. And when, as you said, when, you know, tough times got going, you know, he stepped up with those same characteristics that made him a champion on the field. And that's a tribute to him. The bummer for me is that in those days, again, this is back when the Sonics were located in Seattle before they became the Oklahoma Thunder and moved away, just classic battles. And the bummer out of this whole thing is that because of our lack of knowledge of what this meant is if he plays, I remember Karl Malone, Malone wouldn't play because he thought by, you know, bumping him and rubbing him just by the sweat glands or something coming into his own body, he could get AIDS. And so he's worried about it. And I'm not saying I blame him or don't blame him, but there's just nobody knew. Nobody for certain knew what was going on. Now, as we look back on it and with all the different medicine and everything, it's just a disappointment that we didn't know more at that time that he could have prolonged his career because he was not at the end of his career. I mean, he was heading there, but he wasn't there.
Yes. If you remember, and once again, I write all about this. He came back.
So
the first thing he did when he realized, as you said, when we learned more about the disease, and I credit David Stern in the book, because I believe that David never got credit for this. David Stern, our commissioner at the time, did a fabulous job of educating the NBA from the top to the bottom, from the owners down to the ball boys, about HIV, and use the NBA as a platform to teach the world about people that were HIV positive. We were trying to remove the stigma of that. And so as a result, Magic wanted to play in the All-Star game that year, and David Stern let him. And Stern was in a really tough spot because of guys like Karl Malone and Mark Price. And there was a player that played for the Australian national team that publicly said, I'd rather take a silver medal than play against Magic Johnson. What amused me was that he thought that Australia would medal at all. They weren't going to get any of the three medals. So I don't even know what he was even talking about. But David Stern allowed Magic to play in the Olympics. Then, I'm sorry, first in the All-Star game and then in the Olympics. So Magic was sort of building a case, okay, that you can play being HIV positive. And then the next year, he came out of retirement and came back. And so now I have Magic Johnson on the team, and everybody in the world knows he's HIV positive. And so we go to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and we're going to play the Cleveland Cavaliers in a preseason game on the campus of the University of North Carolina, in the Dean Dome. And Magic gets a fingernail scratch in the game. So now he's got an open wound. It's a non-bloody wound in a control situation, but it's an open wound. So you got to cover it. So there's a timeout, and I'm looking at it, and everybody else is looking at me.
I remember there was it's really an infamous picture.
Yes. So what Magic didn't know was not only were these players on other teams talking about playing with him, his own teammates were coming to me behind his back and saying, are you sure this is okay? Because these guys play against him a few games a year. I have to practice with him every day.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, yeah, it's fine. You can't get it that way. It is a difficult disease to get. You really have to go out and get it. Okay. But now he's got the open wound. I got the gloves in my pocket. I actually wrote David Stern asked me to write the protocol for treating a bloodborne pathogen during an NBA game because there wasn't any protocol prior to Magic. converting seropositive for HIV. And I look up and I see how everybody's looking at me, and I say, there's no way I'm putting these gloves on, because it would be sending a mixed message to all my players, all the rest of the players, and the entire world.
And that's what that photo was all about.
You got it. Yep. And so I was not willing to do that. Now, here's the rub on this, is that Magic saw the same thing I saw, everybody looking at him. And he felt that he was hindering the game. So he retired again. I think if he didn't retire, it would not have been that big of a deal. But because he did, he was on the front page of every newspaper in the world, and he wasn't alone. I was there with him.
Yeah.
And the headlines are reading, athletic trainer doesn't treat HIV positive player. So OSHA gets involved, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. There's a huge investigation of why, you know, I treated an HIV positive player. And it was a big can of worms. It was a very difficult, stressful, and dark time in my life. But I felt like I did the right thing. I stood by it. David Stern was not happy with me. Jerry West wasn't happy with me because I broke the protocol. And I said, you know, you do what you have to do, you know? I mean, but this is what I had to do. So I kept my job, and here we are years later. I retired 3 years ago. And, you know, over a career like mine, you get memorable things.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the autographs, the pictures, the jerseys, the shoes, the balls, my most prized possession of my career is when I retired, Adam Silver, the current commissioner, sent me a letter. And he described how I handle that. And he congratulated me for removing the stigma of HIV for Magic and other HIV-positive people. So it took several decades, but in the end, you know, there was vindication.
Yeah, you know, so as you're telling this very heartwarming story, and you were talking about Magic earlier, and about character, and about in the face of serious amounts of adversity, stepping up, you know, in a completely different way, you did the same thing for Magic. You did it for yourself because that's who you are. That's your character. And that's why probably you lasted 32 years through all these different coaching changes and craziness with Lakers. But I think that's probably what stood out the most, which prolonged your career, because you're making decisions that kept the integrity of the game and the integrity for yourself in play.
Yeah, I mean, that's not for me to say. I guess, you know, the only thing I can tell you is that I knew what I had to do. I mean, it didn't really come from my brain. It came from my heart, I guess. You know, I just couldn't do it. I don't think that makes me heroic, you know, or courageous. I just think I did what I was supposed to do. And I don't think you get extra credit for doing what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, but it's how you're judged years later, you know.
Well, see, that's what I'm saying. So I don't think I did anything special. The problem was I was criticized for doing what I was supposed to do.
Yeah.
I wasn't looking for accolades. I didn't, you know, but I didn't want to be criticized either. I just did what I was supposed to do.
You were doing your job. Okay. Look, we were sitting up here in Manhattan Beach. I'm looking out to the left, out your window. I see the ocean. And this would be absolutely no different than there's somebody out there drowning, and you swim out on a stormy day and bad riptides, and you save this person. You bring them back to shore. And then people criticize you for you know, swimming out there, risking your own life, you know, storm, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you're just going, I was doing what anybody else would do
That's
at that
right.
time. And
yeah.
And by the way, I happen to know that person that was in the water, was about to drown. It might have been your daughter, mm-hmm. right? And you're doing what was best interest based on that moment in time. And that's the same thing that you did.
Right. Yeah. So I don't think it was special, but what was special for me was that after all these years, Adam Silver
recognized it.
I mean, he didn't have to.
No, man. You know? But it was a moment. It was a significant moment in time.
Yeah. Especially for me. I mean, I had letters that people wrote me telling me how great of a thing I did, and I had hate mail from people, you know, like, how could you touch an HIV positive person, you know?
But think of your decision on the other side. Like, we're sitting here now, I don't know, I mean, you're there for 32 years, you retired 3 years ago, and when this happened, is call it 15, 20 years ago, right? And think of if you had made the wrong decision, like how you would be sitting today with that on your heart versus what you did, which was the right thing.
Yeah. Well, you're right. You know, what would have happened? So you put the gloves on. Magic still sees everybody looking at him, and he retires. And then the story is just that Magic retired. Instead of Magic retired and athletic trainer treats HIV positive. I mean, it's the same. You end up in the same place. It's just that, you know, I got raked over the coals for doing what I was supposed to do.
But you're recognized years later.
That's correct.
Let me move on to a different subject. So a guy, one of my favorite players of all time, and because I was a Sonic honk, right? I didn't like the Lakers, right? Because they usually, at the end of the day, in a seven-game series, they'd usually go the seventh, and the Lakers more than once would always, you know, go out on top on that. But one of my favorite players to watch was Larry Bird. Mm-hmm. And you had, literally a front-row seat on all those games he played in. How great was he? And it was so ironic that those two became best pals.
Yeah. Larry Bird was one of the greatest basketball players of all time. And like I say about Kobe...
Not the most talented, right?
No.
Yeah,
he's,
all those
he's
things.
Big. Larry's a big guy, but... Couldn't jump over a piece of paper. I mean, he was slow. You know, people had to help him on defense. But he, you know, he had a way of being in the right place at the right time, seeing the play develop before it actually happened. Extremely high basketball IQ. Could shoot the lights out. I didn't like him. Still don't. He's a Celtic.
Yeah.
You know, but
I can certainly understand that.
Yeah, but respect them.
Yeah.
Of course I do.
Yeah.
You know.
I think Magic would probably say the same thing. I mean, he's closer, those two have become friends, but just that there was that natural, like, competitive hateness, you know, between those two teams and those two players for a long time, and almost to me a little bit like Gretzky, you know, not very big and not that fast, but just was always one step ahead of everybody, and that seemed to be a Bird's game. Let me ask you about a couple other people. I was asked by a friend of mine, DK, I'll give you a shout out, that he wanted to know who, in your opinion, was the best defensive player. And I started to think about it, and the word and the name that he came up with was Michael Cooper.
Yeah, I would probably agree. Michael Cooper, another great defensive player, was Dennis Rodman.
Oh, yeah.
Scottie Pippen was a great defensive player.
But for the Lakers.
Okay. Oh, for the Lakers?
Yeah.
Actually, we had Dennis on. I had Dennis Rodman on the Lakers for a short period of time. By that time, he wasn't the same defensive player that he was with the Pistons, but he could still play. For me, Michael Cooper. You know, one of the things about defensive players, you know, we use the term that they're long, okay? Really long, you know, their reach is very important, and they can move quickly on their feet and anticipate what the offensive player is doing. They study the offensive player and they take away, you know, their best stuff and make them go to something else. And that's what makes offensive players great, that the defense can take away what they're best at, but they find another way to score. But I would say, yeah, I would say, and even go another step further, that Michael Cooper is one of the greatest athletes that I ever worked with.
Cooper Loop, right?
Yeah.
The Shaq-Kobe relationship, was that all what was reported in terms of the friction?
Yeah, it was worse.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, I talk about it in the book, and I say that it's really easy to blame Shaq and Kobe for the demise of the team. But let's face it, they were just kids. Okay? They were young, giant egos. Both wanted to win. Both wanted, you know, it to be their team, which is normal, okay, for young, aggressive, great basketball players. So they weren't really doing anything abnormal. They were just being themselves. The problem was is we had two of them on the same team. Usually those kinds of personalities are peppered throughout the league. And when you put two on a team like that, neither one of them's going to budge. So I put the blame on the rest of us. I take it off of Kobe and Shaq. It's not their fault. It's our fault. It's all of us. We had ownership. We had management. We had coaches. We had athletic training staff. We had other players. Fans, everybody was a part of it. Right? When you have a situation like that and you do not take care of it, then it becomes divisive. And when it's divisive, people pick sides.
Yeah.
People within the organization, players pick sides, coaches pick sides, management pick sides, ownership pick sides, the fans even pick sides. And when you have that, then the whole thing disintegrates. That should have been a team for a decade. If Shaq decided that he wanted to win every game, we would have won every game. That's how great he was.
Oh, yeah.
But he had a different thing in life. He didn't care about being the best. You know, and I have this whole theory about big men. You know,
we probably share the same, because I've been around, you know, you're on the basketball side, I'm on the football side, and that thing inside that in your heart, you know, is hard to measure, because he's got the stats, he's gigantic, 7'2", 300 and whatever pounds, powerful. You know, and you know, of all the offensive and defensive linemen that have played, you just can't measure like what's inside, how hard they're going to hit and get after it.
Yeah. He was so great that the game was sort of boring to him.
Yeah, too easy.
And it's like that with a lot of big men, because when they're big kids, they're channeled into sports in general, let's say basketball. You're channeled into basketball because you're big. And then you realize that people treat you a little bit better if you're an athlete.
Yep.
And then they go to high school and they get treated even better. And now the girls like them because they're playing on the basketball team. And then they find out they can go to college and then get more girls and more attention. And they find out they might be able to play professional basketball and you get more girls and a lot of money. But the motivation is never really about the basketball. It's the things that you get from basketball. Yeah. Whereas the smaller players are generally gym rats. They can go in the gym all day long, all alone, and work on their handle, make up these scenarios in their head that the clock's winding down and you're throwing up the last shot, you know, and it goes in and you win the game. What's a big man going to do? He's going to go and do the Mike and drill, you know, left-handed layup, right-handed layup. He's going to stand under the basketball. How long can you do that before it gets pretty boring to you? And a lot of the big men like the competition. They like the game, but they don't like to practice. Practice is boring. And a lot of that had to do with Shaq. But because he was so big, he needed to practice for several reasons. This was my argument with him. Yeah. This is how him and I used to get into it. I said, listen, man, you need to practice for a couple reasons. One, conditioning. You got to keep your weight down. You can blow up. The second thing is you're so big, you take up so much space on the floor that when you're in the game is different because of the spacing. Sports, baseball, football, basketball, it's all about spacing. Yep. It's where you put people. Right? If you're not in practice, then whatever it is we're practicing is not the same as what we're going to see in the game. And you're going to play the way you practice. We need you on the court. And so we used to, you know, battle over practice, and then Kobe would be out there, you know, practicing hard and seeing Shaq, you know, didn't want to practice, and those two got into it, and then it just snowballed from there.
I can only imagine. I can only imagine. So I'm going to put you in a pickle a little bit, last question, and that is, which coach, Phil Jackson or Pat Riley, could get more out of the team that they were given, the cards they were dealt?
Now, that's an interesting question. You know, you'd probably, to be fair to both, you probably could say that they were both had the ability to get the most out of their players, but they did it in different ways. And, you know, especially with Phil. So Phil, by the time he came to the Lakers, he already had 6 rings. So he came in with instant credibility, sure, instant respect. He didn't have to earn the players' respect. And he had a 5-year contract at $5 million a year. He had a $60 million contract. Okay, I'm sorry, $12 million a year. $12 million a year for 5 years, $60 million. When you pay a coach that kind of money, the message you're sending to the players is this guy's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
He's the coach. It might be easier to get rid of you. And so Phil had that kind of credibility and clout behind him where Riley had to earn it when he came in. He was not a great NBA player. You know, he scratching to stay in the league, you know, but he was a very intense guy, and he worked really. He had a great work ethic, and he had a way of knowing how to push your buttons to get the best out of you psychologically. Like, one of his things was he felt for a criticism to work, he had to give you 4 compliments. So Riley would drop these little things on, hey, you did a good job with that. So that when he told you, hey, you didn't handle that very well, then it meant something.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're criticizing people all the time, or you're raising your voice or yelling at people all the time, then when you actually need to raise your voice and get their attention, there's no place to go, because yelling has become like talking, you know.
Yep.
And so they both, I think, got it done, but they got it done in different ways. You know, I was a big Riley fan. You know, he's the guy that hired me. He's the guy that gave me my break. He's the guy that said to me that, I'm going to mold you into what I want you to be. He told me that I hadn't been scarred by the NBA yet, and that I was moldable. Okay? And he taught me many, many things. And, you know, I owe him everything. And I will say this about him, that he never embarrassed anyone. And he treated everyone with respect all the time. If he had something to tell you, he did it privately. You know, he called you in his office or someplace else, but he didn't embarrass people. And you can't say that about all coaches.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, he was the beginning of that whole Showtime, you know, and it played out. So finally, where can you get the book?
You can go to vdbook.com, or you can go to Amazon and just put my name in the search box. If you go to vdbook.com, then that'll take you directly to the Amazon site.
Yep, and that's VITTI.
That's correct.
All right, there he is. Thank you so much. This has been an awesome podcast. You know, I rarely go an hour and 10 minutes, but this was a special one, and you really accommodated the time for it. You've got so many stories, you know, in the hopper, and I really appreciate you sharing them with me.
Thanks for having me, Mark, and I look forward to listening to our conversation and the other podcasts that you do in the future.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.